The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
Hi, it's Patrick Cox here. And this year's Nobel Prize in Medicine has just been announced. It's gone to a Brit and two Norwegians for their work in neuroscience. And the Norwegians, their names are Maybrit Moser and Edvard Moser. I hope I'm saying that right. They are married. That's why they're both called Moser. Over the years, their research has been published in high-prestige journals, you know, like Nature and Science. These are, of course, English language journals. And that's how it goes in the world of science. You write in English. Why, you may ask? There are thousands of other languages out there. Why English? Well, on The Big Show, as part of our translation series, In Other Words, we asked Michael Gordon about this. He's a professor of the history of science at Princeton, and he's the author of an upcoming book on the language of science. What follows is an extended version of a conversation Gordon had with The Big Show's Marco Werman. And so we wondered, how is it that so many scientists all over the world write in English? Here's Gordon.
To me, the question is, if you look around the world in 1900 and someone told you, guess what the universal language of science will be in the year 2000, you would first of all laugh at them because it was obvious that no one language would be the language of science, but that some mixture of French, German, and English would be the right answer. And the second thing you would say is German. If it has to be one, it will be German. So the story of the 20th century is not so much the rise of English as the serial collapse of German over the course of the 20th century as the up-and-coming language of scientific communication.
So we'll get to that in a second, but let's go back before 1900. I mean, when I went to school, all the taxonomy of species was in Latin. I mean, doctors still use Latin to describe anatomy. So when did Latin lose out?
Latin's place in the history of science is somewhat strange. It was, of course, the universal language of communication in Western Europe from the late medieval period, say around 13th century, until about the mid-17th century. And then it started to fracture. It started to become one of many languages in which science was done. The first person who actually started publishing extensively in their native language was Galileo, who switched to Italian. He was translated into Latin so he could be read everywhere else, because that was the one language everybody would be expected to read in this tiny community of natural philosophers.
And Galileo, in his original writings, it was in Italian?
Galileo's earliest publications are in Latin, but then he switched after 1610 or so into mostly Italian.
So fast forward now to 1900. We've got these three possible languages that could win out to dominate science, or maybe a mix, as you say, of all three, French, German, and English. What were some of the geopolitical dynamics in the 20th century that kind of led to English becoming kind of the language of choice for science?
So the first dynamic, which I want you to keep in the background, is the rise of the United States, which is a long 20th century story. But the heart of the story will be a series of geopolitical conflicts that center in Europe. The first major shock to the system of basically having a third of science published in English, a third in French, and a third in German, although it fluctuated based on field and Latin still held out in some places, was World War I, which had two very major impacts, long-term delayed impacts, but impacts on this ecology of scientific languages. The first impact is that after World War I, the Belgian, French, and British scientists organize a boycott of the Axis powers' scientists, such that German and Austrian scientists aren't invited to conferences, don't publish in Western journals, and increasingly you have two kinds of scientific communities. One Germanophone, which functions in the defeated Axis powers, Germany and Austria, and then another that functions in Western Europe, which is mostly English and French. The reason why that matters is it's that moment, 1919, 1920, 1921, when international organizations to govern science start getting established, like the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry. And those organizations function bilingually, English and French. German, which had been the dominant language of chemistry, is written out. So that's one long-term effect. The boycotts lifted in 1926, but the damage is a long, slow fuse, but is underway. The second is also caused by World War I, but happens across the Atlantic. Starting in 1917, when the United States enters the war, there's this massive wave of anti-German hysteria that sweeps the United States. At this moment, something that's often hard to keep in mind, large portions of the U.S. still speak German. There's large areas of the Midwest where German is a very common language that one hears in Cincinnati, in Iowa, in Wisconsin, in Minnesota. Mm. And there's this wave, this backlash. German is criminalized in over 23 states. You're not allowed to speak it in public. You're not allowed to publish in it. You're not allowed to use it on the radio. You're not allowed to teach it to a child under age 10.
That's pretty harsh.
It's extremely harsh. It's hard to imagine this happening now. In 1923, the Supreme Court in Meyer v. Nebraska overturns all these laws as exceeding the constitutional capacity of the states. But for a while, that's the law of the land. And what it does is absolutely devastate foreign language education in the U.S. In 1915, Americans were teaching foreign languages and learning foreign languages about the same level as Europeans were. And after these laws go into effect, foreign language education drops massively. Isolationism kicks in the 1920s, even after the laws are overturned. And that means people don't think they need to pay attention to what's going on in French or in German.
So, Michael, bring this back to the language of science and how English kind of ends up by dominating. I mean, can you make any connection between the lack of language education in this country and why English has risen up as the dominant language of science?
Absolutely. What you end up having is a generation of people who come of age in the 20s, who are in school in the 20s, come of age in the 30s and 40s, who have no exposure to foreign languages or very limited exposure to foreign languages. That's the moment when the American scientific establishment starts to take over dominance in the world, and you have a set of people who don't speak foreign languages. They're comfortable in English, they read English, and they can get by in English because the most exciting stuff to their mind is happening in English. So you have that generation of people who have no exposure to foreign languages. In the 30s, now, in the 20s and early 30s, Americans often went to Europe to get their PhD or to study as a postdoc. J. Robert Oppenheimer did that. Linus Pauling did that. And those people learned German then on site. With the rise of National Socialism and Hitler's government in Germany, foreign travel gets cut off heavily. And so those postdoc networks break apart. And so you end up with a very American-centric and therefore very English-centric community of science after World War II.
There were a lot of German scientists who came to the U.S. After World War II. How'd they feel about working in the tongue of the the victors of the war?
When German scientists came over, they come over in sort of two waves. There's this first wave that are a bunch of refugees from the 1930s who are fleeing, being fired because they're of Jewish extraction or have left-wing views or just don't want to work in Hitler's Germany.
Albert Einstein,
most of
for
them,
one, for example.
Albert Einstein, for one. He comes over in 1932, even before Hitler, and just chooses to stay. Einstein's a special case. I'll get back to him. But most of the people who are young just quickly adapt into English. The ones who are older find it hard, but especially those who are Jewish, and this is where Einstein is really quite significant, don't want to speak German anymore after they learn about the Holocaust. And so for Einstein, whose foreign language knowledge is actually very weak, his German is beautiful and his French and English are quite weak, find this a difficult conundrum. They want to speak their own native language, but they feel politically that that's a difficult thing for them to do. But what ends up happening is people speak the language of the victor because A, Germany is not in a position to argue for its national rights or pride in the late 1940s and 50s. And secondly, the efficiency gains of having people all speaking one language are just tremendous. Scientists come to value that communicative, audience-centric way of thinking much more than speaking in their native language.
The history around this is so rich. I'm just wondering, like, if you go back and try and determine the etymology of a scientific term, are you looking into history kind of the way you're looking at tree rings to find out, you know, what was happening at that time in science and what you can determine? Yeah. Is there a good example of that?
There are a couple of good examples of this. Let me give you two. The first is oxygen, which is now a term that basically everyone knows as the thing we breathe. That term has a history, has a birthday. It's born in the 1770s and 1780s as Antoine Lavoisier and other French chemists are creating a new theory of burning. And they need a term for this new notion of element that they have constructed. And they pick oxygen from the Greek for acid and maker, because they have this theory that oxygen is the substance that makes up acids. They're wrong about that, but the word acid maker is what they create, and they create it from Greek. That tells you that French scientists and many European scientists in that period would have a good classical education and would know enough Greek and Latin to put things together. The English just adopt the word wholesale. They take oxygen and turn it into oxygen. But the Germans don't. The Germans translate each term into Sauerstoff, acid substance. And the same is true in the Slavic languages as well, where they take the acid term in their own language. So when a German says oxygen, they actually think about acid in principle because it's there in the word. It is for us too, but we don't know enough Greek to pick it out. So you can see that at certain moments, certain words get formed. And the tendency was for Germans in particular and the Slavic languages in the 19th century to take French and English terms and translate them into German or Slavic roots. Now that's not true. Now terms like online, transistor, microchip, that stuff is just brought over in English as a whole. So you see different fashions about how people feel about the productive capacity of their own language versus just borrowing a term wholesale from another.
Has the global use of English in the sciences actually affected English itself, do you think?
It certainly has affected the English that scientists use. When you're speaking to a large proportion of non-native speakers, and most people who are scientists or engineers in the world today do not have English as their native language, when you're speaking a language to those people, you tend to flatten out certain features of the language to increase communication. So there's enormous emphasis on the passive voice in scientific writing and scientific speaking. There's much simpler sentence structure, fewer subordinate clauses, etc. And there's a general tendency to cut back on culture-specific metaphors, such as cricket or baseball metaphors. So when scientists talk to each other, there's a particular kind of scientific conversation they're having when they talk about science that has a very restricted character, almost like it's a dialect.
Give us an example of a sentence where the passive voice is used to describe something sciencey.
The acid was titrated over a bath of phosphoric salts.
Gotcha. Instead of the acid being active, which seems to be a kind of a hard thing to do.
Or what's actually the case, I titrated this over a bath of this. In the 18th century and earlier, the tendency in scientific writing is to use the first person. Mm. I did this. We did this because you want to say that I am a trustworthy person and I did this, actually did this. The tendency now is to speak as if nature is doing it itself.
That's interesting.
And so the experiment just happened.
In one's mind reading that, what changes?
It depends who you are when you're reading it.
Right.
If you are someone who's a scientist reading it, it looks familiar and it looks neutral. And this is a major part of why English has maintained this and this increasingly dominant position in the world today, is that the language looks neutral. So the Dutch and the Spanish and the Brazilians and the Japanese, when they use it, think they're not using America's language. They think they're using the language of science. And it has that studied neutrality where personality and style are flattened so that it is universal.
Michael Gordon, great to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And Gordon's a professor of the history of science at Princeton. He's also the author of a book to be published next year. It's called Scientific Babel, or if you like, Scientific Babel. It's so confusing. I say both tomato and tomato. Kind of depends who I'm with.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
That's it for today. The home base for this pod is pri.org/language. The pod has a family, three podcast sisters, in fact. Sideshow, One with Farai, and Radio Ambulante Unscripted. The latest Ambulante episode is a really good one. The untold, until now, story of frikis, people into the underground heavy metal and punk scene in Cuba. It's quite a story. You can find it at soundworks.org. That's it for now. The pod's on Facebook. There's a World in Words page. I'm on Twitter under the name Patry Cox, P-A-T-R-I. COX. And I'll be back soon.
Argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. The World in Words is also supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.